Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. You can go to my regular website, which is askdrdawn.com, and then from there, you can click the Contact Us button and send an email. And that's what Anna in Columbus, Ohio did a few days ago to send me this email question, osteoporosis, Fosamax, and vibration plates. Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thanks so much for sharing your knowledge. I've enjoyed your podcast for years. You provide a valuable service to your community and indeed the whole country. My doctor is recommending Fosamax again. I've tried to manage with diet, vitamin D, and exercise since my last bone scan in 2021. I'm 73. So changes in 2021, the bone mineral index was 19.5 with a probability of major osteoporotic fracture of 13 and hip of 4.7. In 2025, it had gone down a bit. Her major osteoporotic fracture had gone up to 16 and her hip to 6.8. I've not lost any height, but maybe lost a little weight. I work out 4 to 5 times a week with a good share of weight-bearing exercise. I eat dairy, lots of leafy greens, beans, grains, etc. I probably need to up my protein as my diet is very plant-forward. And I'll just take a moment, and Anna, since it's a little off-topic, collagen, either my preference being for marine or algae, are two ways to increase your protein quite effectively. This can be added to yogurt. It can be mixed in with your beans. You can get a very neutral flavored protein if you read the labels. And also bone broth. So if you want to start making or purchasing bone broth, that has a lot of very absorbable collagen in it. Continuing with Anna's letter, I most often take 4,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin D3 daily. I'm hesitant to take Fosamax because I have a difficult time swallowing pills and always have to eat to push them down. Otherwise, it feels like they get stuck in my esophagus. I don't normally have any digestive issues. The other known issues with Fosamax also contribute to my hesitancy. I'm not on any prescription medicines at this time. I know you've talked about Fosamax on your show. One more question, if you have time. Do you think vibration plates can help strengthen bones? So I'm going to start with that last question first because I hadn't looked at that for about a decade, and I was pretty disappointed to see what was out there in the last 10 years in terms of research. So I went back further. I found something in 2020 in the Journal of Manipulative and Physiological Therapy. It looked promising. But then when I dug down, because I hadn't heard of that journal, turns out it's a very obscure journal, and they had to pay $2,900 American to be listed such that I could find it or Google could find it on a web search. Otherwise, the article's only available to people who are subscribers, and like I said, this was an obscure journal. It was also not a blinded study. They compared, I believe it was about 300 women, and half of them were in the control group, and the other half got exercises on the vibration plates, and they found strengthening and also improvement in bone mass. But since they didn't exercise the control group on a non-vibrating plate, it may be that the muscle exercises are what caused the increase. So not what we would consider a good quality study, probably accounts for why it couldn't get published in a better journal. I found several large literature reviews, most of which were citing rat studies. So I'm a little ambivalent on it, but back in the 2008 to 2011, there were a number of studies that were positive. My suggestion would be try using a marker for bone loss if you want to maybe get a subscription to a place with vibration plates or use one at your gym. Get a blood test. It's called a C-telopeptide blood test. Get that before you start using the plates. And then maybe after 3 months or maybe 2 months on the plates, get that blood test again. If the C-telopeptide protein in your blood has dropped, that would suggest that you actually are building more bone, that you have turned around that bone balance. So sounds like you're losing bone. So that baseline should drop relative to what you're currently doing if the vibration plate makes a difference. And you also mentioned that you have problems with swallowing. And I did want to mention that stuff getting stuck in the esophagus is a little bit worrisome. I would maybe consider getting a barium study or an endoscopy just to make sure that you don't have a stricture or a tight spot. Now, people do get spasm in the esophagus, but stickiness like that always worries me that the person has silent esophagitis. And the fact that you don't have digestive issues, unfortunately, doesn't mean you don't have silent esophagitis, because often the first thing to go are the nerves. With respect to swallowing in general, there are two injectable drugs for osteoporosis, should you decide, based on what I'll be telling you in a minute, that you would want to go there. One of them is an IV bisphosphonate that's given once or twice a year. I recently had a story a few weeks ago showing that just one dose of this stuff tended to preserve bone, and this was a placebo trial. Very interesting, because that's way below the dose, but these were women who were osteopenic, but not less than minus 2.5 on their T-score. And what they showed was that even a single dose of this had reduced fractures up to 10 years out in this group. So quite substantial reduction in a low-risk group. Let's go back to risk, because your probability of major osteoporotic fracture of 16 sounds like a lot. But actually, the threshold for treatment is 14 to 20%. Now you're over the 14, so your doctor's urging you at 16 to do it. But I would point out that in the United Kingdom, they use 20%. And the United Kingdom actually pays for the drug and the hip surgery, so they tend to be conservative, but also recognizing that they do want to have a risk threshold. And risk, you know, this percentage of risk, I want to emphasize that the relative risk reduction of these drugs, the Reclast or the Prolia, which is an autoantibody against a bone breakdown protein, so it slows down bone breakdown. Both of these agents reduce risk, and they reduce the risk ratio by about 33%. And that sounds really good, you know, reducing the risk by 30%. But when you ask the question, and it's a dramatic contrast here, what is the number needed to treat? Well, you would have to treat 100 women for 3 years in order to prevent one fracture, because the absolute fracture is not that big in the spine. When you take a look at this, it's very hard to parse it out. But I like it when I look at that number needed to treat. Most of your fracture risk, in other words, is your fracture risk, and the bisphosphonates reduce it by 30%, but you still have to treat 100 women for 3 years to eliminate one fracture. So that kind of puts it in perspective. Any prior fractures would definitely, if you've broken anything, fell on your wrist and broken a bone, ankle bone, something like that. As an adult, postmenopausally, I would consider that, even after 40, to be a flag. If you have a smoking history, if there is a family history for fracture, or if you have used steroids, then I think it's important to factor those in. And if you go to the University of Sheffield, or just type into your browser Sheffield Frax, F-R-I-X, you can enter in all of your data and perhaps get a little bit more accurate in terms of what your absolute risk is. Your hip risk, yes, it's higher than threshold. That threshold for the hip is greater than 3% in the United States, greater than 6% in England, and you are at greater than 6.8. So, but on the other hand, the absolute benefit is kind of low. So I hope that clarifies it a little bit. I know this is a very complicated issue. I just keep coming back to that number needed to treat to prevent one fracture is 100 women for 3 years to kind of help me put the benefit of the agent in perspective. A couple of scientific curiosities to roll out the news stories this week. Let's start with news of the, well, slightly bizarre news, but a lot of what we talk about this program is going to be our new fantastic, amazing toy box when it comes to basically building biological things. Now, scientists have been hoping to bring back some version of the woolly mammoth, and the team at Dallas-based Colossal Biosciences want to be the first to do that, but it's hard to operate on elephants. For example, elephants take 22 months to gestate. So the cycle time on trying to mutate their genes is, well, rather ridiculous. Woolly mammoths have two very useful traits, one of which being that they have a nice insulating coat of wool, and the other being that they had a way of metabolizing fat that helped them survive in the cold. So the researchers found and tweaked the corresponding genes in mice and then implanted altered embryos into females. They did this using CRISPR in the altered mice, depending on the technique, and I think given the technique that they used, probably not breed true. They ended up with, however, these very sweet yellow fuzzy mice that look like nothing so much as a baby chicken, except, of course, they have fur, not feathers. But, oh, my God, the picture is the same. It's, you know, baby chicken with ears and a tail. I'm sure that this could be a real product if the company can scale this. I'm sure these mice will be a desirable pet for the 1% who can afford them. They're awfully sweet looking and I'm sure extremely cuddly. All right, moving on to something that is not just a scientific curiosity. Tea turns out to be useful for your health in more ways than one. Most of our research is focused on caffeine, an antioxidant, cognitive improvement, relaxation. But a new study suggests that tea may have another surprising benefit. It can strip out contaminants from your water. Just as plants can pull contaminants from the soil, plant leaves, that is to say tea leaves, naturally absorb heavy metals like lead, cadmium, and arsenic. And you can essentially cleanse that water by simply taking out the tea bag or filtering out the leaves. You're taking the metal out of the water with the tea, and then if you don't eat the tea leaves afterwards, well, you've just reduced your exposure. Schindel and colleagues at Northwestern University found that the purification effect increased the longer the tea was allowed to brew. Overnight steeping, like you might use for iced tea, was more effective than doing it with hot water for a few minutes, but even just 5 minutes of steeping led to a 15% reduction in lead concentrations. And while this paper does not address that, if it gets cadmium and arsenic, there's a good chance that it's also absorbing other things that we'd rather not have in our water. I'd love to see data on perchlorate, for example, which shows up in many wells all over the country, but especially in California. So we'll see where that goes, but hopefully they'll be broadening the analytes that they test again, and hopefully we'll have some good news. I will tell you that just drinking 5 cups of green tea over a day has a substantial reduction in both heart disease and cancer. according to studies that have been done on exactly that. Do green tea extracts work just as well? Well, I hope so. Although I have switched over from black to green tea for much of my tea drinking. I just haven't found a good Earl Grey that I made with green tea. So I'm not getting that 5 cups for sure. Another bit of news you can use is insomnia, right? Something that many of us suffer from. A recent meta-analysis of 25 studies involving data from over 2,000 people reported that anywhere from 12 to 20% of people over the age of 60, the focus of this study, suffer from insomnia, and at least 40% report feeling sleepy during the day. And of course, we know that sleeplessness is linked to depression and anxiety. And the research found that while all forms of exercise, aerobic strengthening, etc., resulted in better sleep, strength training by itself had the biggest benefit. Weight training also carries a lower risk of injury, particularly from a fall, when you do more intense workouts. Sleep experts say the link between weights and better rest makes intuitive sense. Sleep is essentially recover for wear and tear on the body. Resistance training puts literal wear and tear on the muscles, so this may trigger the brain to produce more sleep hormone and improve the detoxification necessary to get you down into the deep sleep. So, yeah, give it a try and see what you think. Recommendations is whatever you do, do it. Give it at least 2 hours after doing it before you actually try to go to sleep. More from the toy box. A biohybrid hand, which can move objects and do a scissor gesture, has been built by a team at the University of Tokyo and Waseda University in Japan. The researchers used thin strings of lab-grown muscle, naturally, bundled into sushi-like rolls to give the fingers enough strength to contract. These multiple muscle tissue actuators, as they called them, and that I like their acronym for that, it's MUMUTAs, created by the researchers. These are a major development towards the goal of building larger biohybrid limbs. Now, this is just the lab environment, thinking about biological robots. The robot hand managed to master the art of a scissor gesture. It's made of 3D printed plastic with tendons of human muscle tissue that move the fingers. And this biohybrid hand is 6 inches long and has multi-jointed fingers, which can move individually and make gestures. The idea was to get this hand strong enough for contractile force to drive a large hand structure like this. Up till now, most of the artificial muscles have been used for very small, lightweight materials. But they were able to use these fingers to grasp and move the tip of a pipette. So it's only a matter of time. Muscles did fatigue after about 10 minutes of electrical stimulation, but recovered within just 1 hour of rest, rather similar to living tissues. And so we're not there yet, but I wonder what that looks like online. I'm going to have to go and see if I can find a photo. So we've got a caller. Hello.
Yes, is that me?
That's you. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
I'm Helen, and you're right. I'm Santa Cruz.
Okay,
County.
Helen. What can I do for you?
I just have a quick clarification question.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, you were talking about how tea, especially steeped overnight, clears metals, heavy metals, toxic metals, reduces exposure. And then right away, you went to the benefits of green tea. And I am wondering, did that study with contaminants in water, was that green tea or black tea? Did they differentiate?
They did do both.
Okay.
So I think it's tea leaves. And that doesn't surprise me because it's the same species of plant. The difference between black tea and green tea is simply fermentation.
Right.
So yes, the fermentation process that makes the tea black and changes its flavor doesn't affect its ability to absorb.
Okay, so either one. And then if we do tea bags, we throw out the tea bags. If we do tea leaves, we throw out the tea leaves. And then I assume that tea is usable to drink.
That's exactly right.
Right. Got it. We just throw out the bags or the tea leaves. Wonderful. Great. Okay.
You know, sometimes with tea bags, most of us don't eat those. But
no.
I'm going to stop composting my tea bags
because I do
compost my tea bags. And looking at this,
too.
I'm like, well, probably for me, it isn't an issue because I use RO water. So I'm clearing the metals from my water, hexavalent chromium and some of the other fun things that you get during living in a rural area. So, I would say if you are using that in your vegetable garden, that may not be the best idea because you're possibly reabsorbing it into your food plants.
The toxins.
Yeah.
So if I just have a compost metal bin that I take outside, I'm a renter, to the compost bins and put them in, I've been doing that with tea bags.
Yeah.
But whatever the city takes for composting then is getting the heavy metals.
Yes, assuming there's heavy metals in the water in the first place. So I think I'm going to just make now that we know that it's bioconcentrating that stuff, probably best to just throw them in the landfill.
Throw them in landfill, right. Okay. Well, thank you. I'm glad I called.
Thank you
very much.
I'm glad you did as well. Bye-bye. Keep listening.
Bye-bye.
Let's do one more story here. Okay. About a month ago, I talked about the pig heart transplant, might have even been 2 months ago, and the reason that they were able to use this genetically altered pig was that they had used CRISPR to get rid of a common surface antigen, a marker on tissue that's it's a kind of a carbohydrate called alpha-gal. Alpha-gal is not found in humans, and it's not found in certain primates. So there's a syndrome that humans can get, and probably primates as well, called alpha-gal syndrome. And what happens in this case is people become allergic to red meat, and they can have an anaphylactic reaction. This is bad, and I've had a few patients who actually got it. It's caused by being bitten by a particular tick, the Lone Star tick, which is not prevalent in Northern California, but is widely seen in the middle Atlantic states like Virginia, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Kansas. And it's estimated that maybe 10% of unexplained anaphylactic reactions may be due to alpha-gal syndrome in these areas. Another problem is people who have this can develop cross-reactions. That's to say they can become reactive to things that are not, strictly speaking, alpha-gal, but are close cousins, a kind of molecular mistaken identity. Some mammalian-derived ingredients like gelatin, and which is used in many medications, keratin, another animal-derived product which is used in some shampoo, and lanolin from sheep's wool, which is used in deodorants, might also be things that people would react to. So for those with a mysterious type of skin reaction or what feels like a food allergy that the allergist isn't coming up with, you might think about getting tested for antibody against alpha-gal. That's a very simple serology test. Any laboratory can do it. So we were talking just a moment ago with a caller about composting, and this just in from the FDA. The FDA issued a warning that forever chemicals, the per and polyfluoroalkyl substances that are found in Teflon, that this could be a problem when sewage sludge is used as fertilizer. Now, for decades, the EPA has encouraged the use of sludge from treated wastewater as a cheap fertilizer, and it didn't set any limit on the levels of PER or PFAS. This stuff is all over the place, and it just does not break down in the environment. Although we're working on, with our biological toolkit, we're working on finding bacteria that might be able to break it down. In a new study, the EPA found that the risk from contaminated fertilizer can exceed safety thresholds, get this, by several orders of magnitude. That translates to between 10 and 100-fold levels. This assessment was published in the very last days of the Biden administration, and they warned that farm workers are primarily the ones who will be affected here. Sewage sludge is used on less than 1% of fertilized land, so probably the general food supply is okay, but not using sewage sludge at all is an important way to protect our essential workers. And those PFAS I was just mentioning, a second article that I've been kind of holding on to for a few weeks to wait for a good tie-in, a new study published in Environmental Epidemiology looked at drinking water contamination using zip codes, because this is published data based on your zip code. Your water supply is analyzed. This was looking at a monitoring program that was since closed down during the first Trump administration, monitoring detectable levels of PFAS in California drinking water from 2013 to 2015. So they cross-linked that with zip codes, and the findings suggest associations between the predicted prenatal PFAS exposure that the mothers would have had from living in those zip codes and certain childhood cancers, including acute myeloid leukemia and Wilms tumor, a type of kidney tumor. This data was done on, they had 10,000 children up to age 15 diagnosed with cancer and 30,000 healthy children, and they looked at geocoded addresses at birth and essentially correlated that with local water district contamination. They found that areas with higher levels of these two PFAS were associated with these childhood cancer. So emphasizing again the climate justice aspect of the environment, and just when I think about this, plus the particles, plus the altered nutrition that people in lower economic brackets suffer from, it seems to me that we are, well, effectively poisoning through neglect an entire generation of people. And I feel extremely, extremely bad about that. This is commentary and recent research coming out about Ozempic and other GLP-1 drugs like Wegovy, Mounjaro. They've been recently linked with all sorts of amazing health benefits besides weight loss, from reducing cancer risk to curbing addiction. Researchers at the Departments of Veteran Affairs analyzed the medical records of about 2.5 million people recently, comparing the health outcomes of diabetes with patients who received GLP-1s to those given older treatments. Those on the medications had lower risks of 42 different conditions, including liver failure, lung failure, cardiac arrest, psychosis, schizophrenia, alcohol, or drug addiction. The drugs even appeared to reduce brain inflammation and lower the risk that a person would develop Alzheimer's. On the flip side, though, researchers found higher risks of some unpleasant side effects such as nausea, kidney stones, gastrointestinal issues, arthritis, and rarely stomach paralysis. There's also a very, very rare kind of sudden blindness that has been reported, although I think I haven't seen numbers on that, and I think it's vanishingly rare. We tend to think of drugs as surgically designed to do only one thing, but the reality is almost never like this, says epidemiologist Ziad Alalai, the study's key author. It's important to systematically examine the effects on all body systems, he continues. And I certainly agree with that. I have here another article on the topic looking at heart failure. And in this study, these were people who had heart failure with preserved systolic function, and they got 2.4 milligrams once a week or placebo. And they improved quite a bit more. They had a 13% weight loss versus 3% on placebo. But over the course of 52 weeks, they also improved in the 6-minute walk test and had a lower likelihood of hospitalization for heart failure. Now, hospitalization for heart failure costs a lot of money. So is it possible that widening the approval of this drug for these conditions might save us more money on the back end? Well, I'm not a sufficiently good enough mathematician to tell you that, but it does raise the question, and that's interesting all by itself. Our next Ozempic and GLP-1 story, however, starts with a story of a man, Chicago trial attorney John Drews, very well-off person, lawyer, upper income echelon, divorced, empty nester. He was a foodie, and he indulged himself with his food spending budget. But then, in May of 2022, he went on Ozempic, and it changed his life and his behavior. And that's something I want to emphasize here. This is a success story because this person changed their behavior. And if you go on these agents and don't change your behavior, you will gain the weight back. You don't necessarily do so if you do what John Drews did. First of all, he lost 25 pounds the first year and then 75 pounds more the following year. And he completely changed everything. He stopped spending money on food because he really couldn't taste the food. He stopped going to coffee shops and began buying different foods. A study by Cornell University shows that GLP users are spending a lot less at coffee shops, and they're also spending a lot more in exercising or joining gyms or getting personal trainer. There's also changes in the economy. The food purchases have changed. Recent analysis shows that people are spending more money on exercise wear, more expensive clothing, and fitness clubs, I think I've already mentioned. But our fellow Drew now exercises every day. He's changed to a very high lean protein diet. I'll give you his diet. Typical breakfast is 3 eggs, a half cup of egg whites with overnight oats, blueberries, and half a banana. Lunch is ground venison or ground bison and vegetables. Dinner, salmon, sweet potatoes, Brussels sprouts, and broccoli. Notably absent from this are bread, noodles, rice, and snacks made of ground up grains. His snacks are a combination of yogurt, raspberries, cocoa nibs, peanuts, and nuts, other nuts. And he doesn't drink any more alcohol. He stopped going out with friends because he has a hard time finding that. So instead, his friend activities involve events and physical activities. It's not that he's spending less. It's that he's spending differently. And so sales of lean meats in the first half of 2024 were up 27%. Sales of whole fruits and vegetables in the same period up 13%. Sales of snacks and confections, chocolate hard candy, sugar-coated treats, were down 52%, with prepared baked goods tumbling 47%. This is pretty amazing economic shift Furthermore, the clothing industry is benefiting because our friend Mr. Drews has lost so much weight, he's had to rebuy his entire wardrobe 3 times, and he lost 8 inches in the waist, 2.5 in his neck. Now he was an XXL when he started, and now he's a medium. And so what's going to keep this person on their new path? All of those behavior changes. Also, the natural changes in his microbiome that come from eating a different diet. Those foods start to be more desirable. The high sugar, very sweet foods become less desirable. It takes about 6 months to shift the manipulation of the microbiome to diet, but that's the thing. The GLP drugs help people get through that 6 months by altering their brain perception. Do we have to use this synthetic drug with all of its potential side effects? Well, maybe not. The next Ozempic might be something you already have in your body. Of course, AI comes to the rescue, and by screening 20,000 protein-encoding genes in the human body, Stanford researchers have identified a naturally occurring molecule that works like semaglutide to put the brakes on appetite and weight gain. We will, of course, not list all of the benefits. I think I've belabored that point already. But skipping right along, this was the article that mentioned a 7-fold increase in a very rare form of blindness known as eye stroke. And I will research that further, and because this is the first article I've seen it in, and I have literally nothing to say about it. But you can rely on me to have something to say about it at some point in the near future. So the researchers were looking for a molecule that would fit into the same receptors. They were looking for a natural alternative, encoded DNA, and they focused on prohormones. Prohormones are very tiny molecules that become active when they're chopped up into smaller parts, short chains of amino acids called peptides. And this is done by other enzymes that are floating around. And some of these peptides actually work like hormones, which is, of course, how semaglutide works. It raises the level of a hormone. They found a small peptide called BRP after scanning all of these other proteins, a algorithm called peptide predictor that analyzed thousands and thousands of genes that encode for prohormones. And they found this BRP, which has only 12 amino acids, and yet it increased the action of neuronal cells in the brain tenfold over controls. In other words, having that Ozempic-like effect in the brain, but it did not work elsewhere in the body, presumably because the prohormone either wasn't being made or it was being broken down differently. This is important because semaglutide affects not just the brain, but also the gut, the pancreas, and other body tissues. And BRP affects just the hypothalamus, which controls appetite and metabolism. So they made this stuff, and they gave it to mice and mini pigs. Mini pigs really closely mimic humans, more than rodents. They found that one injection reduced eating for about 4 hours, and daily injections for BRP for 14 days caused the rodents to lose about a tenth of an ounce in fat, which is actually pretty good when you're a mouse and only weigh a few ounces. They noticed it didn't affect their pooping. It didn't affect their water intake or movements or behaviors. It wasn't acting like a stimulant. So now it's a matter of scaling this, figuring out how to make it, getting it past the FDA, and proving that it is safe and effective. But the idea that it is only active in the brain certainly goes a long way in my mind to making me feel comfortable about it being safe and effective. And we have a caller on line one. Hello, tell me your name and where you're calling from.
Nick in Santa Cruz.
Well, hi, Nick. What can I do for you tonight?
Well, I have a question kind of along the lines you were talking just a few minutes ago. So I am down to, say, about 123 pounds. I'm 70 years old. I don't usually, can't really lose too much more, but I want to find out how can I build up my muscle mass. Mm-hmm. You know,
You said 133 pounds?
About 123.
123.
About what I wore.
And how tall are you?
About 5'8".
5'8". Okay, so that's pretty thin. I'm not going to run it through the calculator, but at 5'8", at 68 inches, you know, we'd be thinking that like a clean weight would be 140, 145. And as you get older and lose weight, unfortunately, a fair amount of that weight comes through muscles. Have you noticed a decline in strength? That's a very important point.
Well, not really. I do a lot of yard work and so forth. I try to keep the calcium in my bones by, you know, doing that sort of thing, walking quite a lot. So I try to stay physically active in my yard and do pull-ups and sit-ups and push-ups and
good. And
like
and there's been no decline in your capacity. So that's... or no?
Right. Nothing that I've noticed.
Okay, good. Now, bit of advanced guidance. You're going to want to be very careful if you get laid up or get sick that you continue to do as much muscle work as you can. And that could be just using resistant bands in bed but trying to work your muscles a little bit every day and not just, you know, lie there flaccid even if you're quite sick. So, you know, really keep moving. It's the body will cannibalize, particularly if you're vomiting or you have, have to have surgery and they make you fasting for your surgery or you go in fasting and then it gets delayed and then they kick it to the next day and you have like a little lousy little dinner at night and meanwhile you're just lying there in bed. That's a recipe for getting weak fast. And so I can't emphasize the importance in older people to just keep moving. So good for that. My bet is that you probably are not absorbing as well as you used to. You can put the calories into your stomach, but the question is whether or not the digestive properties and the active transport in particular is still as fast as it used to be. Things like amino acids actually burn calories to be absorbed. This is a process called active transport, and to get one amino acid into your bloodstream, you actually use one molecule of ATP. So that's another way that as people age, if their absorptive capacity drops, and there can be lots and lots of reasons for that, reduced production of stomach acid, reduced production of pancreatic enzymes, or just reduced enzymatic capacity, like the number of transport vehicles, you know, the number of conveyor belts in the small intestine has decreased. So you have to flood the system with more protein. And my recommendation for you is to look at your diet, maybe you could work with a nutritionist and have them help you. There are all sorts of very good websites that are inexpensive. You know, look at the ads, let them send you some junk mail and they'll help you calculate. But the idea is to figure out what your total protein consumption is and then try to get that consumption to 1.5 times your body weight in kilograms. So let's see, you have a weight of 123. So I'm just going to do the calculation right here, but I take 123 and get to a calculator, Don, and divide that by 2.2. And that's your kilograms. So calculator, where are you? 123 divided by 2.2. Most of you have probably done this in your head by now. It's been a long day. Okay, so that's 55. Then we're going to multiply that to 1.5. And that gets us 83 grams of protein per day. So to get there, you're going to have to probably use protein powders or protein supplements. Because I don't, and, you know, the fellow I was talking about with the Ozempic who was doing lots of nuts and lean meats and stuff. He was getting it that way, but he was eating quite a lot of meat and eggs, which mm-hmm. may not necessarily be the healthiest way to get that protein. He's exercising a lot, and I hope that his cholesterol numbers are good. Certainly he's been losing so much weight, I would hope that they are. But nevertheless, over a high-fat diet can be safe, is safe for many people, but we want it to be a high-protein, high-fat, high-exercise diet if you're going to do that.
I see. One wrinkle is that I've got a kidney disease. I guess it's maybe the first stage of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my understanding is protein is maybe not such a good thing to be doing.
Not if you hydrate adequately. If you're at like a stage 2 kidney disease, it's not a problem. And besides which, so if your GFR is above 45,
mm-hmm.
then you're probably fine with just, you know, if you're going to do the 1.5 grams per kilogram, you probably need to be really clear that you're getting the 2 liters of water a day and not let your urine, not make your kidneys work too hard to get rid of all that extra nitrogen.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I have to be sure to be drinking now.
Mm-hmm. So I would work up on the water for starters. Get that.
GFR, I think, is above 40.
Yeah. Well, if it's a 45 is kind of normal for someone your age, and although the little thing says 60, they don't age adjust it, and it gets too complicated when if you're an African American it's this, and if you're over 65 it's this, and you know, it just makes your head spin. It's like the modern vaccination schedule, which is, you know, very complicated, and it's a good thing we have AI, honestly, because it's gotten crazy. And well, if you had this shot then when you were 65, then now you should have this shot, but if you had lung disease, then you should have this other shot. It's crazy. But from the kidney standpoint, the number I've seen in the literature most recently is 45. You're going to be alive. Your kidneys are going to be alive. And you will handle the extra protein, but you shouldn't push the kidneys by hydrating. And certainly ibuprofen, in particular, the non-steroidals over long periods of time can stress the kidneys. I'd stay away from those, and monitor you're going to monitor the GFR and you're going to monitor the potassium. But really talking about it being a problem for people with like late stage 3, or stage 4, where they're trying to avoid dialysis, and it doesn't sound like you're anywhere near that. And that's when we have to put people on a low-protein diet. I remember a patient I had some years ago who she had pretty advanced renal failure, so they had her on this high-starch diet, and she was diabetic, so she was taking all this insulin, and she was crashing her sugars and killing brain cells, and I'm like, oh, great. Do we kill the brain or do we kill the kidneys? And that was a very, very complicated and challenging set of circumstances. Fortunately, yours are much simpler, and I hope that the advice I've given you will help you improve your muscle mass and obviously resistance exercise. Certain amino acids, the branch chain amino acids, tend to be very useful. So if you do go into protein powders, going to want to make sure that you're getting at least 5 grams of leucine, L-L-leucine. That's the one that has the strongest effect on promoting muscle growth.
Okay. Yeah. So I hardly ever sit down during the day. I'm always walking around doing something. So I suppose that's a pretty good thing.
Well, that's good for your bones. But in order to stimulate new muscle, you have to have the protein present, and you actually have to injure the muscle, micro injury. So you actually have to push it.
Got it.
There's endurance and there's strength. And you sound like you've got good endurance.
Yeah, I think so.
But you actually want to be pushing your strength.
Yes, I remember reading an article, it came from the British medical system that if you do jump rope every day, it actually strengthens your bones.
Very definitely. That was a study. I quote that very often. And that jumping rope causes an electrical impulse, just like a crystal radio. The bones are crystal. And when they are compressed, they create an electric impulse. That electric impulse goes to the DNA of the cells that are the bone building cells and revs them up, because they're going to be healing little tiny micro fractures that you've caused by that compression. So it's very good to jump rope. And in that study, it was women in a nursing home. Problem with jumping rope is, of course, there is a fall risk. So I like to know what the person's bone, whether they have substantial osteopenia or osteoporosis. And if there are people who say, well, trampolines work. I haven't really seen the data on trampolines. And as I mentioned, if you were present at the top of the hour, I haven't really seen the other data that I'd like to see on those vibrating boards. Unfortunately, I have to go, but thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.